From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. The Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, met with the President of Poland today, and she thanked the country for taking in almost 3 million Ukrainian refugees. And yesterday, she led a congressional delegation to Ukraine, this as the Russian assault continues there. For more, we're joined by Alex Horton, military reporter for The Washington Post, our editorial partner, and he's in Kyiv. Hi, Alex.
Hey, Scott. Good to be here.
Over the weekend, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other members of Congress went to Ukraine to meet with President Zelensky there, and the U.S. is considering an additional more than $30 billion in military help. What do you hear from combatants, from families about how they sense the war is going and how they sense the support for Ukraine from the outside?
I think there's a great sense of pride in how the war has gone for Ukraine so far, and a lot of that comes through in music, in street signs, in, you know, I saw this guy come out of a coffee shop the other day and, you know, he had a Ukrainian colors pinned to his backpack. You know, there's little touches like that. You go into a restaurant and sometimes you hear sort of like a recital of like the soldier's creed or anthem. Mm-hmm. They're very expressive and they're very proud of their military in a way that's sort of interesting. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's not like the U.S. where we have this sort of long history of the military and nationalism sort of wrapped together. This is sort of a new thing for Ukraine.
Yeah. Alex, you wrote a powerful article in the Post from Ozera, just outside Kyiv, about the burial of a man named Andriy Vosnenko. Tell us about him, what he did during the Russian invasion and in the civilian resistance.
So Andriy drove a truck. He delivered fish around town. And when the Russians came in late February and occupied Ozera, he used the truck to go around town, deliver fresh vegetables to people who were afraid to lose their homes or the ones who were kicked mm-hmm. out. And he also helped the family of one of his friends escape to Kyiv. What he would do is he would walk around town and he would just note the locations of Russian vehicles, Russian positions, artillery pieces, things like that. And then he would pass them on to Ukrainian officials.
Oh, he was kind of the eyes driving around and noting down positions.
Exactly. You know, he was out a lot, and his a friend of his thought maybe that raised suspicions of why they kept on seeing this guy. Mm. So he was wounded by what we think was a mortar strike. He was bleeding and he was seeking some help, and that might have caught the attention of some Russian soldiers. Mm. Some villagers saw him being led away with his hands behind his back on March 21st, and that was the last time anyone had seen him until he turned up dead on March 31st.
Yeah. And your headline or subheadline is that this is a reburial, a second burial. What do you mean?
So we know about the images in Bucha where, you know, civilians were buried in mass graves, and sometimes there are just two or three people who were killed, left there on their own, and civilians would come and bury them, but sometimes they didn't have identification, so people would bury others where they found them with no way of contacting their families. There's been sort of this ad hoc network of priests, of city officials, of normal people. Sometimes they use things like Telegram to post photos of dead people they found. Mm. In Andriy's case, two priests from two different villages spoke, and he said, well, one of the priests told his counterpart, you know, I think these guys might be from Ozera. And Andriy's friend, Ivan, took a look at the photo of him executed and bound and left on the edge of a woodline. And he said, yeah, that's Andriy. He spent a few more days in the ground, and he was exhumed just on Thursday. He was buried the right way with his family.
Oh, so, such a human face of the tragedy that's playing out across Ukraine, of course. Alex, let me ask you quickly about the city of Mariupol in the east. The Russian offensive there continues. About 100 civilians were reported evacuated from the bunkers beneath a steel plant in that city. But reports say as soon as the evacuations began, the Russian shelling resumed. What do you know about these civilians and how they're doing?
Well, they're still making their way out of Mariupol, and this is a promising sign that, you know, there are more to come. There have been so-called green corridors in the past where Ukrainians and Russians agreed on a temporary ceasefire, and it appears the Russians have broken that before. So everyone's sort of watching this closely to make sure this doesn't happen once again. But they're heading away from Mariupol to Ukrainian territory. You know, some are shell-shocked. They're worried that they may end up in Russian-controlled territory, just like some of these people who have been experiencing forced deportations, you know, into the Donbass, where the Russians are organizing just sort of a more robust campaign to get civilians into their grasp.
Alex, you're about to rotate out of Ukraine and to return back to the States. What are you as a reporter going to take away from your reporting?
I think I'm going to take away the idea that this is a marathon and not a sprint. You know, when we were with Andriy's family, they told me, you know, you got to come back after the war, come back and we'll have something to celebrate and not be sad about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I thought to myself, you know, when will that be? You know, is that in 2 months? Is that 2 years? You know, of all the battlefield successes that Ukraine has had, this may go on for some time, unfortunately.
Yeah. That's Alex Horton with the Washington Post, our editorial partner, reporting from Kyiv. Alex, thank you for the time and travel safe.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Back in this country, if you have been grocery shopping at all, you will not be surprised at this number. Prices at the supermarket have shot up 8.5% in the last year. But those high prices, they don't equate to more money for the people who grow the food. Alice Fordham of member station KUNM in New Mexico reports.
Outside a supermarket in Albuquerque, everyone says groceries are more expensive.
Produce that's like by the pound especially has gone up.
Laura Miramontes says food prices are a frequent topic of family conversation.
Oh my gosh, my dad. Yeah, my dad's always complaining.
He's supporting a big family. Another customer, Estefan Romero, also has a family and says he's changed what he buys.
I guess tone it down, stick to more beans and chili instead of, you know, the more expensive cuts of meat and stuff like that, you know?
New Mexico ranks 45th in the states for median household income, so price rises hit hard here. But that doesn't mean inflation is good for the people growing the food. I meet Don Hartman on his farm outside the town of Deming, New Mexico.
Listen how quiet it is and the birds singing.
He loves it here. Usually his crops include onions, melons, and New Mexico's beloved green chili on about 500 acres in this river basin. But times are hard, and as he shows me round, I start to see why. First, there's the fertilizer tanks hooked up to his drip irrigation system.
They're almost empty. That's why I've been pricing around, trying to see what it's going to cost to refill them.
The numbers aren't pretty.
A load of fertilizer right now is running, a semi-load is about $16,800. Same load last year was $6,000.
So that cost has almost tripled. Then there's the tractor, which runs on diesel. He gets through 15,000 gallons of that a year.
Right now, 15,000 gallons of diesel fuel is $66,750. Last year, it was $27,000.
His margins were already tight. Challenges include drought and labor shortages. He lost money last year. But now, supply chain issues and the war in Eastern Europe have driven fuel and fertilizer prices way up. And that's forcing Hartman to make tough choices.
We grew 150 acres of chili peppers. We're back to, I think we're down to 115.
He's also using less fertilizer. Will it be enough to keep the farm afloat? He doesn't know.
Everybody's sweating right now because we don't know what's going to happen, and we're all trying to do the best that we can, cut corners, cut costs, to survive it.
The price he gets for the crops won't reflect his soaring costs, says agricultural economist Anne Schackinger of the nonprofit The Environmental Working Group.
The share of a food dollar that a farmer gets is so small that when, you know, we're seeing these prices of food go up in the grocery store, that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, farmers are really getting any more money for their own product.
And Schackinger says farmers growing things like corn or soybeans get more government help.
A huge disparity between these major commodity crops and the farm subsidies they get, and then the specialty crops like fruits and vegetables and nuts.
So, Jay Lillywhite, a professor of agricultural economics at New Mexico State University, says things look bleak for those growing produce here.
I suspect that we will lose some farmers because those costs are going up.
As well as economic hardship, that could even accelerate a nationwide trend of depopulation in rural areas, which would change the nature of a state like New Mexico.
If we lose farmers, a lot of our culture in this state, the chili growers, our state vegetable and what we identify as a state. So, yeah, the more we lose of that, that will be a challenge. So it's not just economics, but it's also cultural.
Hartman, the farmer, says he could get a regular job, but he sure doesn't want to.
I could have went anywhere. I could have done 100 other things, but I chose to farm because that's what I love.
It's not just a livelihood that's under threat. It's his way of life. For NPR News, I'm Alice Fordham.
The Department of Justice recently ended a crackdown on academics with ties to China. The China Initiative, as it was called, began under President Trump and was meant to stop the theft of economic secrets. But it also targeted professors, often ethnic Chinese professors, for smaller misdeeds. From member station WPLN, Mariana Bacayao reports on one Tennessee professor caught in this web.
In this class, we will talk about the four kind of the
Professor Anming Hu is a world-renowned nanotechnology expert with two PhDs, two published books, and two NASA grants. But he was unable to work for the past 2 years after the FBI accused him of being a spy for China.
That certainly is a darkness period of my life. It's very challenging for me, to understand what really happened to me.
It's a complicated case exacerbated by a language barrier. It started in 2018. FBI agents turned up at Hu's office asking about a lecture he'd given in China.
I know I shouldn't discuss with them without a lawyer. At that moment, I don't know this. I don't know my right.
The agents thought Hu could be a spy. And if he wasn't, he could become their spy. They urged him to go to a conference being held in China and report back to them afterwards.
I see. I don't want to go because I'm pretty busy.
Hu told them he had a full teaching load at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and was in the process of applying for a NASA grant. Months later, Hu was boarding a plane for an international conference in Japan when Homeland Security stopped him. After 40 minutes of questioning, Hu was going to miss his flight. So the agents gave him a choice: stay in America with his phone and laptop, or leave for Japan without them.
I decided to go without a computer, without my cell phone, just with luggage.
Hu wouldn't know it for some time, but the FBI had honed in on the NASA grant he mentioned in their first encounter. The space agency has restrictions on collaborating with non-American companies and universities, and Hu has a summer job at his alma mater, the Beijing University of Technology. The FBI was aware of his grant application before he submitted it. Agents told the University of Tennessee, Knoxville to approve his paperwork. UTK got the money to fund the grant research, NASA got the results, and Hu got arrested. In the summer of 2020, Hu was in house detention with a mountain of legal fines, no source of income, and no family in town, since his lives in Canada.
And almost every day, I try to communicate with them. And each night, I try to tell the one story to my daughter. I haven't saw her over 2 years.
Hu was one of more than a dozen academics tried for research integrity under the China Initiative, though the program's mission was to uncover and prosecute economic espionage. By the time the trial began in the summer of 2021, the FBI hadn't found any evidence that Hu committed economic espionage or that he intended to defraud NASA.
I've covered federal cases for 20 years, and the feds generally put together an airtight case.
That's investigative reporter Jamie Satterfield.
But in this case, their primary investigative effort was to do a Google search.
A university administrator testified that the FBI told her Hu was hiding his ties to China. So when the agents told her to send his grant proposal like normal, she asked the university's legal counsel for advice.
And she says, I'm concerned about this. I'm about to put my name on something these agents are saying is a fraudulent act. And she was told to do it anyway. And so she did.
Hu's trial ended in a deadlock last summer. And by the fall, a judge had thrown out his case. But the government's actions have had lasting effects. Professor An Chi Lin is the director of the Lieberthal Rogers Center for Chinese Studies at the University of Michigan. She found that 60% of Chinese American researchers are now uncertain about their future in the U.S.
I have absolutely seen the movement from the university being really supportive and helpful and proud of its international collaborations to an environment in which every collaboration is sort of reviewed and double reviewed.
Anming Hu's wife told him he should leave the U.S. immediately after the trial, but he wanted to stay.
I want to continue in the U.S. I shouldn't give up. I don't want to give up. I want to continue.
In a statement, the University of Tennessee Knoxville provost says the school is pleased and grateful to welcome Hu back to the faculty. He now has tenure, back pay, and $300,000 to rebuild his lab. The Department of Justice ended the China initiative earlier this year, but An Chi Lin says some people charged under it are still being prosecuted.
I think if we begin to see that these cases that the Justice Department says they still have confidence in, if we begin to see that those cases truly have some substance to them, and or if the Justice Department really starts dropping cases where they don't have good evidence, that will tell us that it's over.
The Justice Department didn't reply to our requests for comment. And Hu remains skeptical of the department.
I don't think that right now is the justice. Before we learn the lessons, before we take the action to avoid a similar case happening in the near future, that's not the justice.
For Here and Now, I'm Mariana Baca-Yao.
All right, sports fans, round two of the NBA playoffs began over the weekend. There are four teams left in the East, four in the West. So, who's rolling, who's sputtering, and what about those super teams with super expensive free agents? What happened to them? Well, let's bounce past the mic over to Jerry Brewer, sports columnist at the Washington Post. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, it's great to be on with you.
Nice to have you. Okay, over the weekend, exciting finish in Game 1 between the Golden State Warriors, the recent champs, and upstart Memphis Grizzlies. Let's take a quick listen.
Inbound to Thompson. Thompson fakes, fires, three-pointer. Bang! Klay Thompson from downtown, and the Warriors back up by one. Bane to Clark. Clark to Morant. Morant on the drive. Scoop layup. No good. It's over. Golden State holds on and wins Game 1.
So, Game 1 to Golden State here. How do you see this matchup going?
Well, I think they're going to see a lot more games like that, maybe not down to the last possession, but you're talking about a Memphis team that, when healthy, has size. They have an incredibly explosive guard in John Morant. The Golden State Warriors, the Splash Brothers, are a team that's rather small, very aggressive, a great three-point shooting team, and I think that's going to be a game in which there's a lot of wild variation and swing. I wouldn't be surprised if that's a 6 or 7 game series.
Oh, yeah. Now, staying in the West, we have the top seed Phoenix Suns facing off against the Dallas Mavericks. There have been injuries to key stars. Devin Booker for Phoenix, Luka Doncic for Dallas. Both are coming back. Is health going to be a big factor in this series?
I think health will be a big storyline for the rest of the playoffs, you know, in these final eight teams, because I think all of them have certain injury factors. But you key in on this one because it's the two best players for each team. Devin Booker with a hamstring injury, and then Luka Doncic missing some games in that series. He seems like he's come back and been his MVP caliber self. This series really underscores an important theme in this NBA season. If you're going to win a championship this year with all that's going on, it's best to have depth. And the Phoenix Suns are the best, deepest team in the NBA, and that's why they were able to get past round one without Booker for a few games, and that's why you'd still have to consider them the favorite as we enter the conference semifinals.
Yeah. Okay. So fly over to the East. Defending champion Milwaukee Bucks beat the Celtics handily in game one. The Celtics had a pretty easy first round. They swept Brooklyn. This round looks harder for Boston.
It's a lot harder because they have to face, I think, the best all-around player in the NBA in Giannis Antetokounmpo. And what a great thing Milwaukee was able to do in winning that first game on the road. Because they're without Chris Middleton likely for this entire series. He has a knee injury, so there goes that injury theme once again.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and finally, the top seed in East, Miami, opens up against Philly. The Sixers have MVP candidate Joel Embiid injured with a facial fracture. So what are the odds going forward for Philadelphia?
It's going to be extremely difficult for Philadelphia, and this is where Philadelphia made the marquee trade deadline move of the year in acquiring James Harden, and he's going to have to play at the old MVP James Harden level. He has not played like that for most of his time in Philadelphia. There's been questions about his conditioning and so on and so forth. He's had a rough adjustment to being the number two option. Embiid is out. Yeah. Now they need him to be the number one 30-point-a-game guy, except he's facing, in Miami, perhaps the most ferocious defense in the league when they're clicking.
Yeah. And quickly, it's notable the team's not in the playoffs. Two of these so-called super teams, the Brooklyn Nets and the LA Lakers, that paid big money for expensive free agents. You've written that this could signal an end, do you see it, to these superstar pack lineups that, you know, spend huge money for free agents?
I think teams are always in need of stars, and if you can get big-time stars together, they're going to continue to try. However, this idea of doing that in an inorganic manner, stripping your team down to sign them in free agency or stripping your team down to make big moves in the trade market, I think, once again, as you see, depth is such an important factor. That's not a good decision in today's NBA.
Jerry Brewer, sports columnist for The Washington Post. Thank you.
Anytime.
We at Here and Now hate to use the R word, as in recession, but the U.S. economy shrank last quarter. The stock market dropped some 8% last month, and the Federal Reserve, well, this week it will likely raise the cost of borrowing. So what does it mean for all of us? Let's get some answers from Jill Schlesinger, business analyst at CBS News and the host of Jill on Money. All right, Jill, not long ago we were talking about a post-pandemic boom, but now you write the supposed roaring 20s are morphing into a whimper. What happened? What morphed?
If we go back 2 years ago, we had a deep but short recession, a two-month recession, essentially, in the spring of 2020. And then to kind of get us through that deep freeze, the government sent out money, the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates to zero. But then as things started to thaw, we did get into an overheated part of the economy, and we see inflation at 40-year highs. And now what's essentially happened is that inflation has stayed higher for longer. The Fed's raising interest rates, as you said. And the fear is that maybe they're going to raise rates by too much, and maybe we're just going to go into a recession simply because rates have to go higher to contain inflation.
Yeah. Mm. The geeks, the financial geeks on Wall Street, specifically the bond market, are worrying about what happens to be a very reliable predictor of recession. Here comes a big phrase, the inverted yield curve. Normally, if I lend money to the bank short term, say 1 year, I get a small amount of interest. And if I lend longer term, I get more interest. But that's now upside down, right? I mean, what's going on? And is it that a lot of investors have more confidence in the longer term, but not the shorter term?
Well, I think that investors are worried that the Fed's just not going to be able to thread this needle of increasing rates without throwing the economy into a recession. So for this very short period of time, there was a little inversion where, gosh, you know, you could lend money to the government and get a higher interest rate for shorter term than longer term. Now, that relationship, that inversion, kind of has to stay inverted for 3 or 6 months before it like sort of predicts a recession. So we're not there yet, but, you know, the wager is the Fed goes, raises rates, they go too far, we're in a recession, then they have to start lowering rates. And that's kind of the whole inversion bet. And we don't know when a recession is coming, but it is clear we do know that recessions come from time to time. It's not pleasant, but it is part of the economic cycle.
Yeah, I mean, and so here we might be again. If we're indeed heading into a recession or at least a softening, what do I do, say, if I'm saving for retirement or if I'm thinking of buying a house?
You remind yourself why you're investing. Most of it is for long term. You do know that you have a diversified portfolio. But by the way, that's not helping you so much right now, but in the long term, it will. You should really figure out if you need cash anytime soon within the next 12 months. If you do, you should free that money up. You should get a real grip on your own risk tolerance. And there are a lot of people who really worry about their portfolio so much that they're freaking out. And if you really do need help, I advise you to go find someone who will work in your best interest, a fiduciary advisor. You can find one at the CFP website at letsmakeaplan.org or NAPFA, the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors.org. These are places where you can get advice, but not everyone needs that advice. I just want to be clear, but take a deep breath. These periods usually are more anxiety-provoking than they are money-losing in the long term.
Jill Schlesinger is business analyst for CBS News and the host of Jill on Money. Jill, thanks as always.
Great to be with you.
If you rent your home or apartment, you have probably seen prices skyrocket, almost $300 more than a year ago. That's the national median rise. Rents are going up 10, 20, even 55% in Miami. Now, in San Francisco, another super high rent city, renters have a way to push back. A new law requires landlords to bargain with them. It's called the right to organize. And we have Peter Dreyer to talk about it. He's professor of politics, urban and environmental policy at Occidental College. Hello.
Thank you, Scott.
Now, this law passed after renters in San Francisco asked the city's biggest landlord, a company called Veritas, to cancel rent debt during the pandemic, and then they sued for harassment. Is this a bit of a picture of the challenges that renters face in general?
Absolutely. Renters in the United States right now have their backs to the wall. It's really impossible for most renters to be able to afford to buy a home. Rents are going up much faster than wages are going up, and tenants have very little recourse. And so most cities don't have rent control, and the ones that do have rent control don't always enforce it very well. The tenants have very little power, but this new San Francisco law gives them the same kind of organizing power that workers got in the 1930s when Congress passed the National Labor Relations Act, often called the Wagner Act, which gave workers the right to unionize. Uh-huh. And so this is what the tenants in San Francisco now have fought for and won, the right to unionize, so the right to organize and have them represented by their organization when they're negotiating over both rents and conditions with their landlords.
And let me ask you about this new law. In practical terms, the law says landlords are required to meet with tenant associations at least four times a year and bargain in good faith. What does that mean in reality for what renters, what tenants can do, can get?
That in good faith language also comes from the federal National Labor Relations Act, which basically says that in union negotiations, the owners or the employers have to sit across the table and compromise and negotiate with unions. And the San Francisco law puts the same burden on both the landlords and the tenants, which they have to talk to each other and bargain and negotiate. And if either side refuses to do that, they're not acting in good faith. And if the landlord is not negotiating in good faith, then the tenants have the right to withhold their rent.
Okay, so that is the lever, if that's what tenants can do, if the landlords are found to not be adhering to the language of the law.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Now, in San Francisco, this landlord, Veritas, is a big company. What about smaller landlords who own one or two properties? Do their tenants have these new rights too?
Under the San Francisco law, only buildings that have more than 5 units are covered by the law. The goal of the law is to focus on corporate landlords, which is what's happening in America over the last decade or so, which big corporate landlords, including Wall Street, private equity firms, have been gobbling up a lot of the rental housing in the country, particularly large apartment buildings. And this was exacerbated during the pandemic. And so now we're seeing increasingly the number of people living in large apartment buildings owned by absentee owners that that don't really care about the day-to-day conditions of the buildings. They see it as a long-term investment. And that's what the Veritas company in San Francisco, that's why they were the target of the tenant organizing.
Now, this is one law in one city. Do you see any signs of broader trends in renters' tenants' rights? We certainly see more high-profile cases of workers unionizing.
The growing number of workers that are organizing at Starbucks and Amazon and many other companies is a parallel to the growing tenants' rights movement across the country. Wages are not keeping pace with rents. People have very few options. Roughly 35% of all the tenants in the country are fear eviction, according to a recent survey. And so there's been a growing upsurge of tenant activism around the country during the pandemic. They've pushed cities to pass right to counsel laws, giving tenants the right to have an attorney if they're being evicted or face other challenges. Growing numbers of cities have passed laws requiring landlords to maintain their properties in good condition. Some cities are now talking about rent control. In Portland, Maine, for example, the voters voted overwhelmingly for rent control. The same thing happened in Minneapolis in the last year. So we're seeing, I think, the largest upsurge of tenant activism today than we've seen since the 1970s.
Peter Dreyer is professor of politics and urban and environmental policy at Occidental College in Los Angeles. Professor, thanks.
Sure. Thank you, Scott.
Enron, CNN Plus, Quibi. Remember Quibi? All of these are failed ventures, and all of them are names printed on one tech journalist's growing collection of dead company swag. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz has the story.
Hype is key for Christina Warren. For the last few years, she's collected swag, like mugs, t-shirts, pop sockets, from companies that fly high, then crash and burn.
Like I have MoviePass merch and Aussie Media merch, and I have Quibi merch.
She's sort of an accidental collector. It started because she'd come home from tech conferences with free merch, ways to promote a new company, and then realize what she had was sort of a gag.
It's mostly companies, but it is occasionally like disastrous or failed, you know, like online things like Fire Festival.
Remember the 2017 festival that was meant to be a cultural moment, but just turned into chaos in the Caribbean. Warren has real Fire Festival t-shirts, probably some of her favorite items. Look, she knows that for the people who worked for these companies, the end is tough.
I'm not rooting for any company to fail. And I think that because I've been part of startups and I know that when things don't go the way you wanted it to, it can be really painful.
But she knows there is great irony in these ventures that the public can share in.
Fast is another one of those where the hype didn't seem to match with what the company was doing. And that makes the fall that much more extreme, which to me then makes it funnier to be out someplace wearing a shirt from one of those things.
Fast, of course, got a lot of buzz with its plan to help people expedite online purchases. But its CEO announced it was shutting down. There is one company that Warren is dying to get merch from. Theranos.
My white whale, the thing I haven't been able to obtain yet, is I've been looking for something officially from Theranos.
But the price is pretty steep, and she can't be sure the stuff online is legit. She's hoping that a former employee out there can hand something over. Really anything.
I hope that someday I'll be able to get something, whether it's like a mug or I would even take a pen, you know, like a ballpoint pen, I would completely love.
Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
Naomi Judd, one half of the mother-daughter music duo The Judds, died on Saturday. Her daughters Winona and Ashley say they lost their mother to the disease of mental illness. In 2016 on Good Morning America, Naomi Judd talked about her struggle.
I have certain things that I do every single day to help me get out of the depression. So the stigma is horrible. And that's why I'm trying to shout it from the rooftops and tell everybody, hey, if it happened to me, it can happen to you.
The Judds were inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame on Sunday. The ceremony had been scheduled before Naomi Judd passed. Her daughters accepted the honor on behalf of their mom. Here's Ashley Judd.
My mama loved you so much, and she appreciated your love for her. And I'm sorry that she couldn't hang on until today.
Naomi Judd was 76.
Love can build a bridge. Don't you think it's time? Don't you think it's time?
LaToya Ruby Frazier is a MacArthur Fellow. She's known for her photos of communities in turmoil, her hometown of Braddock, Pennsylvania, auto workers in Lordstown, Ohio, and most recently Flint, Michigan. Now, the story of Flint is familiar. Officials changed the water source during a state budget crisis 8 years ago, and that caused catastrophic lead and other contamination to the water. Frazier's Flint photos are on exhibit at the Gordon Parks Foundation in Pleasantville, New York, and are the focus of the upcoming book, Flint is Family, in three acts. Karen Michelle has this report.
It's mostly women, black women, some on horseback, others standing on a field of grass, that a viewer first encounters in LaToya Ruby Frazier's photography exhibition. There's an image of a woman holding a sign proclaiming free water in huge red letters, and another of her laying out her prayer rug in front of the machine that made that water, the atmospheric water generator. On the facing wall, there's a photo of the man who brought that literally life-saving device, Moses West, spraying water on a group of frolicking children.
I remember standing there. I was halfway on the street in the sidewalk. I decided to load my camera with color film. And as I put that film in and started looking through the viewfinder, I hesitated to press the shutter because I had so much emotion. But I knew to click it right at that moment of celebration because it was the most that I had ever seen Amber and Shay and their children so carefree.
Shay Cobb and Amber Hassan are poets, mothers, and best friends from Flint, Michigan, who became Frazier's collaborators during the 5 years she spent on the project, starting in April 2016, showing her the key sites, introducing her to their wide community, gaining trust. At first, Hassan was reluctant to get involved.
I was like, I kind of don't want to do it either, because we were so used to people coming in, and basically they came in for the shock value of the story and to do this, you know, look at poor Flint kind of narrative. And I wasn't really interested in being a part of that because that's not what the story is.
Initially an assignment for Elle magazine, Frazier wasn't sure whether to take on the project. In the end, she made a deal. The feature would be ad-free.
I was like, right, this will get me to a large audience of women in a place like a health and beauty fashion magazine where it's least expected. And since it is the first of its kind, people will be surprised and they will respond. And ultimately, they'll remember the water crisis isn't over.
The project is divided into three sections, three acts. The first focuses on Shay Cobb and her many roles as mother, daughter, hairstylist, school bus driver, musician, and poet. In the second act, we see her family on horseback. They've moved to Cobb's father's land in Mississippi and clean water. Ultimately, though, they return to Flint, where in Act 3, Amber Hassan has returned from an extended visit to Puerto Rico, with a solution to their tainted water in tow, a machine that makes clean water, the atmospheric water generator. There are many photographs of town residents posing by it, with water jugs or hoses in hand, some in their Sunday finest.
When you think about water, you don't consider government.
In the back room of the exhibition, there's a video, stills from Flint, his family, and the voice of Shay Cobb.
When you think about water, you don't consider poison, because poison isn't something you consider for yourself.
Frazier knows her work is important as social commentary.
I'm not making these singular, beautiful objects. These are photographs to tell a story about urgent issues in the 21st century.
For the photographer, the work was a spiritual calling. The resulting book, literally to her, a Bible, a testament to what community can accomplish.
That's really important that I'm showing that type of solidarity and love across religion, across sexuality, across race. It is so essential to my work, and I'm trying as an artist in my lifetime to leave behind what I see my work as a human document for humanity, for this country, to transcend the barriers that have kept us apart continuously.
For Gordon Parks Foundation curator Michal Raz Russo, it's Frazier's ability to give voice to her subjects, having them active participants, that's key to her work as a documentarian.
She shows how, for example, you still have a wedding in the middle of a water crisis. It's important to show those images. The images of triumph are just as important as the images of the struggle. And that's one way that she gives a voice to those individuals and those families. And that's very different than what you saw in mass media.
With every step toward the unknown, your love grows outside its comfort zone.
Amber Hassan and Shay Cobb give thanks for LaToya Ruby Frazier's work with the only thing they could think to give, a poem, here read by Hassan.
Some angels come with cameras and compassion for the masses. And to meet one is to see how people are good.
For Here and Now, I'm Karen Michelle.
To see some of LaToya Ruby Frazier's photos from the exhibit Flint is Family in Three Acts, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. ¶¶